Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I am O'Brien McMahon, and this is People Business.
In this episode, I'm joined by Shannon Boyle, Global Benefits Practice Leader at Lockton. Shannon has been working with multinational organizations for over 20 years, helping them navigate their benefits outside the United States. She has lived in the United States as well as abroad in Latin America and Europe, and has a wide breadth of experience when it comes to understanding what local countries need when it comes to benefits plans, as well as what organizations need to think about from a broad strategy when it comes to what they offer from a global benefits plan. This was a conversation I have wanted to have because I've been having more and more conversations with clients around their global benefits. I don't know if it's coming out of the pandemic or other factors, but it seems like a lot of global organizations who have not centralized their global benefits or at least gotten their arms around the cost and strategy are really starting to pay attention to this right now. And so wanted to have Shannon on and talk about kind of from the base level on up to the more complex, what companies need to be thinking about when it comes to global benefits. I will give one plug here, which is if you are interested in this conversation and want to talk more about global benefits, let me know. One, just happy to have the conversation. Two, Lockton does hold 3 global benefits forums around the world each year. We have one in the United States, and we have 2 that are hosted internationally, one that's generally in Europe and one that is generally in Asia. So there are a lot of opportunities to continue education if this is something you want to dive deeper into, and I would encourage anybody who is managing global benefits and has those questions to reach out to me directly on LinkedIn. That's it. Without further ado, here is Shannon Boyle. Shannon, welcome to the show. Very excited to have you on today. I've had more and more conversations over the last 12 months around global benefits plans for companies that I thought it was a great time to have you on as our global benefits leader and just talk about what it means to manage benefits around the world and how to get your arms around the complexity and nuance that is global benefits. So very excited to have you on. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Let's just start at the beginning. How did you get into global benefits? And could you share just like the quick highlights on your background and how you came to the position that you have with Lockton today?
Sure. Yeah, I got into global benefits because I actually started working outside of the US around the year 2008, 2009, when I took on a regional role leading Latin America. And that really started my journey in terms of working with multinational companies, helping them with their benefits. At that point, it was, you know, really focused on what their needs were in Latin America. I moved on to have additional global roles and then also led the Europe region at one point. So I was working with a lot of European-based multinationals. And I've joined Lockton about, gosh, it's been about 8 months now, to lead the national practice for global people solutions. And yeah, we're focused on, you know, the needs of US-based multinationals, support they need outside of, for their operations outside of the US.
So, and that's a good point, because I think a lot of the frame of this conversation is going to be US-based companies that are expanding around the world. The US healthcare system is its own beast, unique to any other healthcare system around the world. And the clients that I work with, and we work with, and the majority of the listeners of this show are based in US companies, but a lot of them do have operations around the world. So just for anyone listening, that's the context with which we're going to be discussing here. Let's start and maybe build into this a little bit. So let's say I'm a US-based company, I've grown to scale, and I've got, I don't know, a couple hundred people now maybe, and I want to open an office, say in Europe, say in Latin America, maybe in Asia. I want it to be of size, you know, 10, 20 people, say, maybe even a little bit larger. And we're gonna stand something up from scratch. What types of things do I need to be thinking of as a leader when it comes to total rewards and benefits globally for the first time?
first and foremost is standing up something for the first time. It's the what comes first in terms of employment and legal entity. So you're not going to be able to do much of anything from an employment perspective without the legal entity. So it depends on, you know, how far are you willing and needing to go in exploring, you know, the possibility of opening up this market. The alternative would be to tap into kind of like an employment of record type of a company where you're actually employing people through them. They've already done all of the work to set up the legal entity, and they most often already have a payroll solution, benefit solutions, things that you can tap into and make some choices, some selections, but not, you can't design something necessarily, you know, that is specific to your, just your company. If you know that this is the long-term plan and you've got, you're well underway to setting up that legal entity, you don't have to use those types of companies. You can start hiring yourself. And then what you'd want to do is probably from a payroll perspective, obviously you can contract that directly. And they tend to be less concerned about the number of people. They've got solutions for all different sizes of companies. From a benefits perspective, you're most likely going to want to get into some sort of a pool. So benefit programs that are designed for small enterprises. Again, you won't have very much choice, but you'll have purchasing power because you're pooling your people and your risk with other companies. And most often, you know, to do that, you're probably going to want to work with a broker that already has these kinds of programs already designed and pre-negotiated with insurance companies.
Interesting. Okay. And let's say I then want to add another location and another location, and some of these locations are going to be bigger or smaller. When does it make sense, like at what size per country does it make sense to start to bring some of the stuff in-house and have your own in-house managed programs? And when does it make sense to keep it with an employer of record or a global PEO model?
Yeah. I mean, that PEO model or EOR, whatever, it can get expensive, right? So it gets, as your numbers go up, so do the costs. Yeah. And I would say that the business case for bringing it in-house probably starts to make sense around 15 to 20 people locally, because by then you're able to purchase things on your own and you don't have to pay the additional administrative costs that, you know, a PEO is going to charge you.
Thank you. So you mentioned employer of record systems and you mentioned like PEOs, whatever you want to call them. Are there, let's say we want to take this in-house, are there good global payroll systems? Like that's another technology piece that a lot of companies either struggle with or spend a lot of time on. Are there good payroll companies that U.S. employers can get on that they can manage payroll around the world, or is that still a fractured market?
No, that is definitely, there are a few, so there's not a ton of selection, but there are definitely payroll companies that are operating globally and have been doing so for many years. Payroll has been something that has been, I would say the global aspect of global nature of payroll is something that's been solved for. When you presume your next question is about benefits administration, that's the holy grail. So it's starting to become more accessible to have a global benefits administration partner. In fact, we have a partner that we're working with, has been successfully rolling their admin solution out. What needed to happen, and that's what we're seeing now, is that there's a flexibility in that solution where you're able to offer what is most appropriate in the context of the local country and the size and scale that you are in that country. In some countries, you know, benefits are actually very straightforward. There is no annual renewal process even. There's no open enrollment. So administration can be pretty straightforward. You still do have to manage things like beneficiary designations. And in some cases, you know, countries require certain forms to have wet signatures. So there is some form of administration, but this flexible model where you're able to tone it up or tone it down, depending on, you know, the needs of a certain country, other countries, you know, it is very common to have a flex benefits solution. And for that, you're going to need the appropriate technology for that as well. So I do see this as one of the emerging trends, frankly. Enough companies have put this kind of a model in place and used these global platforms that I do see this becoming somewhat of a momentum behind it, just also given the amount of time and the compliance concerns that companies have when they don't have a global operating platform to tap into. So payroll easier, benefits harder.
Okay. Would you suggest, though, for companies that know that they want to continue to grow globally, that they invest as early as possible in one of those systems so that they can scale on top of it? Or is it one of those things that, you know, it's okay to kind of piecemeal something together and then later, maybe when you're larger and can afford a more expensive system, then you pull it all together? Is there a huge benefit to doing it right in the beginning?
I don't think it necessarily has to be right at the beginning, but if your plans are to grow your company in and have operations in 30 countries, I wouldn't wait until you're in 30 countries, but you don't necessarily have to do it with just the first country outside of the US either. So I think if you're in that 5 to 7 country type range, that's probably when it would be a good idea to start thinking about it and start working on it, especially if your strategic plans have you growing to 30 countries within the next 5-10 years kind of thing. So yeah. Don't wait till you're in 30 countries to start.
Okay. And this might be, I mean, it is a 101 level question, but part of doing this is I want to kind of get in the weeds and be able to make this valuable for people with varying skill sets when it comes to global benefits. You mentioned briefly there, you know, in some countries, there might not be an open enrollment or a renewal. You're just managing beneficiaries. Can you talk to just the variety of the different benefits systems that you see country to country? I would go out on a limb and say ours is in the United States is the most complex and expensive. Outside of the United States, what's the variety look like as far as what these systems can be and what the employer's responsibility is for managing them?
There is a great deal of variety, and it actually varies even from region to region, I would say. So in Europe, for example, the employer absolutely has a role in providing an employee benefit program, but Social Security is an integral part of the delivery of benefits as well, particularly healthcare. So it's definitely different. I mean, you can't, in the US, you can't imagine an employer having to coordinate with Social Security to deliver a healthcare plan. That just doesn't work that way. And it absolutely does work that way in many, many European countries and some Latin American countries as well. Asia tends to be less complex, but at the same time, less reliant on Social Security, as we see, you know, the heavy Social Security systems in Europe in particular. Asia tends to have more complexity, though, because of the prevalence of flexible benefit programs. So designing things that allow employees to make choices and use points or benefit dollars or whatever you want to call them, that's something that adds complexity in a region like Asia. So it's important to be able to get your arms around this. It's not easy, okay? And that's why there are global benefit experts, right? My team, this is all we live in. And it's our job to do the research, stay on top of the regulatory requirements, stay on top of the regulatory changes, which we see a lot of changes every year, different countries. And it's not just changes necessarily to regulations that are directly attributed to benefits, but also regulations on data and data privacy and how that impacts benefit programs. Regulations as it relates to ancillary programs that are not necessarily regarding any kind of an insured benefit, but things like leave policies. We're seeing a lot of changes in that arena right now. So it's not something to underestimate in terms of the complexity.
Yeah, no, for sure. And thank you for that. So we talked about companies kind of starting to grow globally. There are going to be a handful of companies that do that every year. But what I see more and more of is companies that have grown, that have opened their offices, and in a lot of cases have done so quickly over the last decade or so. And now they get to a point where the size of their organization is starting to bear down on them, and the organization that they have around their current structure doesn't hold anymore. And they stop and they say, okay, we need to look at this with fresh eyes. We need to get our arms around this. And that's where somebody like you or me gets brought in to say, hey, can you help us in the next iteration of this? So let's talk to that process and working with an organization that has a global footprint, but doesn't have necessarily any line of sight into that, doesn't have any global strategy in place. Where do you start? Like, what's the first line of questioning you want to ask in helping them start to think through this? Just as a consultant, where does your head go to begin the process?
Well, you know, you mentioned no line of sight. I mean, that's the first thing that you need to do is to get line of sight. So that the process by which you go through, and this is something that your global consultant can help you with, but getting that inventory and understanding what is out there, what's being offered, how much does it cost, what's the utilization, how many people are enrolled, how has the cost grown over time or evolved over time. So just really doing that inventory is a critical first step, because you don't know what you don't know, right? And you can't really figure out, you know, where you're going until you understand the existing landscape. And I fully agree with you. A lot of times it's really not that important until at one point, you know, you get to be of a size and scale and the cost starts to be meaningful. And it's not unheard of to have double digit medical inflation in particular in these countries, in some countries at least. Over time, you know, these numbers start to be more and more important. But yeah, starting off, first off is that inventory. Thinking about that, how you're going to do that is also really important, because it's an inventory that needs to be maintained over time. It needs to be, you can't just do this once in an Excel workbook. As soon as you finish it, it's out of date and you don't want to have to go through this whole process all over again. So thinking about how, not only how am I going to gather all of this information, how am I going to maintain it? Where's it going to live? Where am I going to put it? And then how am I going to keep it up to date? So all of those are really critical first step questions. Once you know what you have, then you need to start asking yourself questions about, well, how am I doing from a competitive standpoint? As we know, the second most important thing that employees consider or candidates consider when they're looking to accept an employment offer, after they ask you about salary, they're asking you about benefits. And so knowing whether or not your benefits are competitive, having a sense of whether that competitiveness is important on an industry level, or is it okay to be, you know, in a general market perspective, and then comparing, right, where is the market or where is the industry versus, you know, what I've got and what do I need to do either to fix some things and make decisions, right? Like, do I want to be in the 50th percentile of the market? Do my benefits need to be just good enough to be competitive? Or are my benefits going to be a differentiator in my total rewards strategy? So those are the kinds of decisions that you have to also be considering when you're thinking about benchmarking.
Yeah, that's the conversation I always like to have. I mean, whether we're working on a domestic benefits program or a global benefits program, is once we get all the data and get our arms around what exists, it's what's the point of this whole exercise in the first place? You know, why are we offering these benefits or these rewards? Do we want to be a leader? Does it need to be an attraction tool? Is it a retention tool? Are we just checking the box, want to be kind of at market so that people don't come or leave because of these benefits? Having some of that clearly defined, and then there's even some stuff beyond that, right? How do we feel about influencing employees' behavior with some of our incentive design? How much skin in the game do we want our employees to have? How much work or not do we want them to do when it comes to taking care of their own health? There's just some great questions you can ask yourself to really actually physically write down what the philosophies are that you want to be beholden to when you're building this out. And I think it's a great tool to use when you're actually making strategic decisions, because then you can look and say, oh, does this align with what we want to do? And maybe it costs a little more, but you know what? This is philosophically where we want to be, and we committed to that as a leadership team. Or, you know, hey, this is going to cost a lot. How do we know if it's aligned with what we want to do? You know what? It's actually not aligned. Here's our goals, and that's not really part of it. It'd be nice, but it's not core to who we are. Let's focus that money and those dollars somewhere else. So I just think that's a great exercise to do, and am always encouraging of our teams and clients to go through that exercise.
100%. And you mentioned strategy and philosophy. I think that that is another critical step in this whole process, is to ask all those questions that you just mentioned and really define, you know, what that benefit philosophy is, what do benefits mean in our reward strategy, and what your benefit strategy is going to be. What we're seeing more recently as well is that companies are starting to take a look at things that maybe are going to start influencing benefit strategy more so than anybody ever thought. When you think about your DEI platforms and the goals that you have there, especially around equity, and if we offer this amount of life insurance in this country and a different amount of life insurance in another country, is that okay? Does that line up with our equity goals that we've been defining? So oftentimes, you know, what we're seeing more often now, I should say, is the strategy and the philosophy are taking on different components of the overarching business strategy that people didn't necessarily used to take into consideration. The same thing is with ESG, especially in the governance side. You know, how are we going to govern this? Who's going to make decisions? How are things going to be escalated? Who has the authority to make what decisions, which decisions, and so forth. So yeah, a lot of different things influencing benefit strategy, but in a good way, because I think that it, again, it provides, as you said, it provides that framework that then we can go back to when we're trying to make decisions and say, you know, yeah, well, we said this, so now we've got to stay with that.
Yeah. I want to come back to the governance piece, because I have some specific questions around that. But let's stick on the DEI piece for a second, because I think that leads to an interesting conversation. I'd be curious, what are you seeing trend-wise as far as global benefits, companies offering global benefits, and whether they go for an equality across the globe or they go for some form of equity across the globe? And by that, I mean offering the same dollar equivalent in benefits in every country versus being, you know, say at the 60th percentile within each of those countries. So being in the same relative position per country. How do you see organizations thinking about that? How many roughly do you see kind of in either camp? And like just any thoughts you have on that would be really interesting.
Yeah. And it's still early days in that. I think as we started this conversation about just getting your arms around, it's hard. A lot of companies are just in the thrall of trying to figure out what they've got, right? But once they do get there and they start thinking about equity versus equality, my experience has been that companies are starting off on the equity side more so than the equal side, with exceptions. There are some companies that say there are specific benefit policies that we absolutely do want to make equal. But for the most part, I would say they are tending more towards the equity side. So
which of those benefits do you see where there's maybe more equality?
Around life insurance in particular, and around also eligibility definition. So if I am going to admit or allow for an employee to cover their spouse as well as their children, and you know, maybe they do have to pay for it, that's fine, but just the fact that they are even able to enroll in a program and get that coverage, that kind of thing is the area of equality that we're seeing more and more.
Got it.
And
that makes sense.
Eligibility is crazy how historically, I mean, eligibility rules have differed significantly on a country by country basis. And we're starting to see that tighten up more and more, again, from an equality perspective. And then, like I said, life insurance. Life insurance, just in terms of, you know, we want everybody to have access to the same level of coverage, regardless of whether that is market, from a market competitive standpoint. It may be more generous than the market is offering, but it's that the death of an employee in one country should not be more or less valuable than the death of an employee in another country.
Interesting. Another tangential topic to DEI is wellness and well-being. And in the United States, we have seen wellness be a big topic of interest for the last 20 plus years. I'm starting to hear it more and more on a global scale, but I've seen organizations struggle to find that global wellness provider. What do you see as the state of wellness or well-being programs around the world today? And how are you advising companies to think about setting something up?
Yeah, I think that too often companies are making decisions to put in a program and contracting with a vendor that claims to have global capabilities. I always caution people there, do a lot of due diligence in that space, because it's more than just having a website that can be translated into Spanish, German, and Portuguese. You know what I mean? Like, having global capabilities is very different than just having a multilingual solution. But too often what we're seeing is that these global contracts, they put it into place, they have these communication strategy and they execute on that. And then there's very little take up. And I think that they're missing a trick in that they're not listening to employees first and understanding what are employees struggling with. And that does differ on a definitely region by region basis, if not country by country basis. That's not to say that the global provider might still be the right solution for you, but it's the way in which you communicate this service and what you focus on, which may be different on a region by region or country by country basis, because that global provider probably has multiple solutions, ways of helping employees with different challenges. But what you focus on when you're doing this communication is a reflection of what the employees told you that they need. And too often, we just don't see that step taken to really do a good job of employee listening before, you know, going through and designing a global well-being program.
Do you have an example of what that might look like?
Sure. To do a listening program can involve a different type of platform. We've got tools that we use to do this. It can include surveys. It can include also some benchmarking in terms of what's happening in local markets. It's gathering information. And if you do it in a way in which employees are allowed to express themselves openly and freely, you'll get a certain level of quality data, probably higher than you will be if they're answering canned questions in a survey. But either one, frankly, you know, can still be a valuable.
Yeah, at least you've got something.
At least you've got something to hang your strategy on. Exactly.
Yeah. And then how does that lend to the customization of the programs? Like you had mentioned listening and then tailoring that approach to each. Do you have an example from a company you've worked with in the past? You don't have to say the company name, but just in how wellness in one country might look different than wellness in another country?
Yeah. And what happens is two things tend to happen. You find consistent themes that perhaps a global well-being company might be able to solve for. But then you'll find those nuanced themes that are more country specific. And there, you know, you're probably going to want to look into, again, depending on the size of the operation in the country, but you're probably going to want to tap into more local solutions. And you have to keep in mind, too, especially U.S.-based multinationals, we're used to being able to tap into programs that maybe are even offered through our insurance carrier. And they're kind of ancillary benefits on top of an insured healthcare program. Because of, especially like in Europe, I said before, the dependence upon Social Security still, you know, there may not be access to smoking cessation programs. There may not be access to well-being before, you know, having a baby, that kind of thing. So you've got to be thoughtful about what do they have access to through existing programs and what are some of the things that I might have to top up. What I've worked with clients on is really a combination of both. I will say that they do tend to focus on larger countries and then have maybe that global platform available to all countries.
One other question about flexing to different markets is a lot of the times what I've seen, especially in middle market organizations, say they've got 20 locations around the world. They've got 10 that have, that, or let's say they've got 2 that have 100 people. They've got 8 that have 40 people. And then they've got 10 that have 2 people or 1 person. Managing 1 or 2 people in a country is very different than managing 200 people in a country. Yep. And yet they're trying to do this all under the same umbrella and same program, trying to make it equitable. How should employers think about those 2 different parts of their population and build strategy, whether it's well-being or just benefits design, to be managing really small groups and really large groups under the same umbrella?
Yeah, and that is a very common situation. I think that what the way companies are tackling this is through communication strategies primarily. To the extent that there are local solutions that they can point people to, they do that. When you've got, you know, 1 or 2 people, there's not much you can do unless you're under what we started talking about, which is the EOR model. But if it's 1 or 2 people, you're most likely giving them an allowance. You're probably not even providing them a benefit program yet. So, but employee well-being doesn't necessarily have to have a third-party solution attached to it. It doesn't necessarily have to have some sort of a platform that you can log into through your phone. Oftentimes it is about, you know, a good communication campaign, one that is really speaking to the needs of the people and how they like to receive information and having a consistent communication dialogue about the importance of people and their responsibility of taking care of themselves and the importance of seeking out help. I think after or during the global pandemic, the thing that we saw really explode was employee assistance programs. Mm-hmm. And that is very, very prevalent now. And those kinds of programs can serve any number of employees. It doesn't matter what size you are in a given location. And so a lot of it is, you know, are you using your EAP? Do you even know about it? Have you tapped into it recently? Do you know the all of the resources that are available to you through the EAP? So a lot of, sometimes it's centering around something that's consistently available. And other times it's really just about having a thoughtful communication strategy.
Regarding EAPs for a second, do you see that the utilization of those has gone up around the world? Because that's always the struggle in the US, is they're great resources for people who have a need, but even just the name sort of turns people off from reaching out. They don't want to go and confess their deepest, darkest secrets to an employee assistance program.
Right.
Even though that's what they're there for, and they're great, and they're great resources, especially in an emergency.
Right.
But it's just, I think they're like one of the worst branded benefits that we have. Do you see that that is different around the world, or is it kind of the same stigma?
I mean, it's kind of the same stigma from a cultural perspective. You know, there's parts of this world where, you know, you would never disclose to your employer things that you're struggling with. It's because culturally, that's just not how this, how people are in a certain country. But I don't think the stigma is necessarily on the EAP program itself. It hasn't been around as long as it has been in the US. And so we do see when companies implement these programs that if they do a good job from a communication standpoint, that they do get considerable enrollment. Yes, blips of utilization, I would say probably more consistent with the US. But again, it goes back to what have you heard from your employees and how can you address the help that they are needing by pointing them to, you know, this resource. EAP is not really a term that's necessarily even used outside of the US either. They'll brand it differently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are some of the names that they use?
Mostly it's like a company care program. So it's like the name of the company.
Much better than EAP.
Yeah. they'll brand it as part of, they'll say, you know, the name of the company and they'll use the word care, or it, they may translate it. But it's less about assistance and more about, or might be even tied, you know, to the brand of their well-being program as well.
Yeah. Okay. That makes a lot of sense to me. I was talking with one of our US team leads and we were talking about EAPs and I was lamenting how antiquated they seem just on the surface because of the name. And he was defending them and talking about the great service. And he had a family member who had used one in a crisis and it had really helped. And, you know, they're great, but it's just a matter of the branding and getting people to use them.
Yeah, I agree.
Speaking of branding, you have mentioned communication a number of times already in this conversation. Yeah. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about was best practices for avoiding cross-cultural mistakes when building a strategy and building communications for these types of programs.
Right. Yeah, this is really important. And it may require more work, or it does require more work up front, but you are more likely to have a successful landing of the messaging if you think about how you're positioning it and going into even the level of detail of tone, the level of detail of the images that you're going to be using. I think about a US retirement program and the images of two people, you know, sitting on their porch holding each other's hands. And somebody from Latin America would look at that image and be like, that's so sad. They're all by themselves. Where's their family? And it just turns them off. Like, I don't want to be those people. I don't aspire to sit on the porch with my, you know, with my spouse hand in hand.
With one other person.
Right. Yeah. I want to be surrounded by my grandchildren and, you know, and have all of my siblings nearby and all that kind of thing. So it's thinking about culturally, how is this image going to be received and how in the tone in which the copyright is crafted as well. Is it, you know, are you using formal language? Are you trying to be more personable? Is that appropriate in a given country? You know, there's countries still today where, you know, you really do need to ask permission of the other person before you start using the more familiar tone. And until then, you need to have a more formal way of addressing them. And that's just part of their language. You have to think about those things. But that customization will go so far in terms of actually landing the messaging and having people, you know, have an appreciation for what you're trying to say to them. So yeah, I can't emphasize enough how, and as you've heard me say too many times, how important communication is.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. And I've interviewed some other folks on this show around cross-cultural communication and just how easy it is to walk into a gaffe. You know, a word that means life in the United States means, you know, something disgusting somewhere else.
Yeah.
That, you know, you could just Google bad translation branding and get 100 different examples of products that tanked because they hadn't realized what it meant in the local country.
Yep.
Same with, to your point, same with images, same with colors, same with any of that stuff.
Exactly.
So yeah, being able to collaborate on this stuff is really, really important, which brings us back to governance. And I want to make sure we chat about this a little bit. You had mentioned it briefly, but can you just kind of redefine what is governance when it comes to managing global benefits? And are there any best practices or are there any thoughts that people should have as they start to think about the governance of their global benefits?
Okay. There's generally two camps in terms of governance model, a centralized model and a decentralized model. And I don't personally favor one over the other. I think it's just important that a company be clear how they want to govern their benefit programs and then set things up to align with that decision. So if you're going to be decentralized, then you need to recognize that you may need certain mechanisms in place in order to be able to holistically view the financials of your benefit programs, but you're not necessarily going to be involved in making decisions over those financials or where money is being spent or how money is being spent. You're ceding that decision to the local business unit. But I still think that it's important to be able to have visibility over it, because otherwise, how do you manage your business?
Yeah.
On the other hand, a centralized model, which frankly is becoming more and more common, and especially as we mentioned early on, especially as companies get to a larger scale, there's more complexity, there's more countries involved. I do see companies tending towards a more centralized model. And that's where there is probably some level of decision making that happens at the local level, but then there's a model, like a delegation of authority model, where it's defined what can they decide locally, what needs to get escalated centrally. And the central model also lends for, I think, more effective ability to execute on a strategy, a consistent strategy, you know, one that maybe can align to that DEI platform that you've designed. But there's more to it. You know, there's a lot more to it when you're in a centralized model, because then you're saying we're going to be making some decisions, and to be able to make those decisions, we've got to have insights into, you know, what's going on. So you have to be more hands-on.
For that centralized model, what are some good practices that you see employers put in place so that they can still tap into the local markets, that feedback, but still keep the centralized decision-making and strategic planning?
Yeah, I think this is where, and this isn't unique to Lockton, this is where something that is called a global benefits management model comes in handy, where you have perhaps a centralized team that is, you know, has the overarching responsibility for managing benefits globally. So they're partnering with a company that also has a local presence in the countries where they're operating and can facilitate in a consistent manner a lot of the things that have to happen every year, whether it's reporting, the renewals, renegotiations, taking benefit programs out to market, evaluating insurance carriers, evaluating point solutions. So all of those kinds of things can be facilitated in a common model, but then executed locally in partnership with a global broker. And that model is commonly known as Global Benefits Management, or GBM.
Okay. And I've only ever worked in this industry at Lockton, so I wasn't sure if that was just our term or that was a broader market term. So it sounds like that is a broader market term.
It is. Yes, it is.
Okay. I'll admit my ignorance there. I want to shift to some of the other kind of ancillary things that go on, because we've spent a lot of time talking about building out your traditional global benefits, in-country benefits, building the governance, building the strategy. But there are some other things that happen with global enterprises, like there's global business travel, you have expatriates moving around and living for short times in different places. So let's talk about expats for a second. What types of benefits are available to expats? If a company wants to send somebody from one country to another country to live for 2 years on a project, what do they need to be doing differently to make sure that that person is covered from a health benefit standpoint?
Yeah, and it's actually not just health, right? It's your disability benefits, your life insurance benefits, your sometimes even your retirement benefits. There are a handful of companies that operate in this space globally. Some really good carriers that have deep expertise in this area and networks and resources that are, you know, completely dedicated to this space. They're all a little different, though. I think what's also really important is for you as a company to understand what your business strategy is as it relates to moving people around, even where they're going to be moving. These global companies, in fact, you know, have somewhat varying capabilities. Some of them are much stronger in places like the Middle East or the GCC countries. And understanding what the business strategy is and then how that connects to an expat strategy is important.
So it's the companies that you're talking about, the vendors that will specialize in a region. And so it's important to make sure which vendor you're paired with based on where your people are going to go. Is that's kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, they'll all claim that they have global capabilities, but they definitely have different strengths depending on where they are. Some of them also might not offer a healthcare plan, but they're partnering with somebody else that does offer the healthcare plan. And so just understanding kind of the nuances of each company and what their capabilities are is really important. And then, you know, understanding your own business strategy and, you know, how that's going to be executed with the use of expats. And it fluctuates, right? So that's the other thing, is to really stay on top of your expat population. It'll change a lot more frequently than, you know, a population that's static in a certain geography. You could have very few expats initially and average age is 50. And then you suddenly, you know, your business strategy develops and you take on a bunch of new expats and now your average age is 35. So, you know, that changes the conditions of the policy, changes the conditions of how things are covered. It's very important that you're on top of your expat data on a really regular basis because of how much it does fluctuate.
Let me ask the dumb question. If these people are going to live for extended periods of time in a country, why can't they just tap into the local benefits?
They absolutely can.
Okay. So why would you put an expat plan in place versus having them tap into local benefits wherever they're going to live?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it just depends on the individual, frankly. Some people are more open to that than others. If you do that, if you do tap into a local benefit, especially when it comes to like retirement, that retirement plan is probably not portable outside of that country. And so, you know, what do you do? You just leave it there and then you go get it when it's time to retire. So
go live there for 6 months in retirement till you run it out.
Exactly.
And come back.
Exactly. So,
yeah,
but it is entirely possible to do that. I think for the most part, I'm trying to think of any country. There's probably a handful of countries where that probably isn't legal anymore. And they're requiring you to do some sort of a expat program because of maybe the strain that people are putting on the local social security platforms. So, you know, yeah, I imagine that there's a handful of countries where that's not allowed, but it is certainly allowed in many cases. It just depends on whether you can convince somebody to take that, not necessarily risk, although it is to some degree risk, right? So you're an expat, you're living in a foreign country, your spouse gets sick, and he or she wants to go back to the U.S. for treatment. You don't have a plan. So, you know, yeah. That's an additional level of risk that some people are just not willing to take on.
Got it. Yeah. Well, and that example right there makes a lot of sense for sure. The other topic I wanted to ask, and I know we're coming up to the end of time, but the other topic that gets brought up a lot, but I think a lot of people still are unclear about it, is this concept of multinational pooling. Can you talk about what that is and when it would make sense to start exploring?
Sure. Multinational pooling involves essentially pooling your risk. So you're taking your risk profile from various countries, putting them all in one bucket, if you will, and asking the insurer to underwrite the overarching pool of risk that you have, as opposed to underwriting each country individually. So obviously, you know, this doesn't make sense when you have very small operations because it's just not a very interesting risk profile. But when you start having even, I would say, upper hundreds and certainly thousands of employees across a number of different countries, it's probably in the, you know, you need to be in the thousands that this could be something interesting. It obviously requires, you know, a level of management oversight. And then you're also going to be working with certain insurers that have these networks in place that you would tap into. It's really predominantly used for life and sometimes also disability. It's rarely used for healthcare just because of the way that the differences, you know, in the way in which healthcare works country by country. But
yeah, healthcare is so unique.
It is so unique. Yeah. But life insurance, you can get a better underwriting result if you oftentimes, if you pool the risk. And you also have the opportunity to perhaps have some of that investment come back to you in the form of dividends. And you can decide, you know, kind of, do you use those dividends to then fund the program or does it go back into the business? Different things that you can do. So there's different financial models there, but sometimes those dividends can also be attractive enough for companies that they say, this is worthwhile doing.
Wonderful. Thank you. And I really appreciate you coming on the show today. I think, as I said, this is just a topic I've seen garner more and more interest over the last year or so. And I think it's going to be helpful for people as they start to educate themselves and think about their own strategies. My last question is a little bit of a setup since we both work at Lockton. You've been here 8 months now, and I just would be curious from your former perspective to the work that we're doing, like what is different about the way that we're approaching global benefits versus what some of our competitors are doing?
I think for me, one of the stark differences that I have come to appreciate is the way in which we manage this company from a financial perspective versus being a privately held company versus the ways in which decisions are made in publicly traded companies. I have been thoroughly impressed with the long-term perspectives that we take with our clients. It's not about chasing down all of those local country appointments and getting those appointments so that commissions can start rolling in. It's more about starting with strategy. It's about starting with inventory, benchmarking, getting our arms around things, and then making decisions on, is this going to be centrally governed? Is it a decentralized approach? You know, how do you want to manage these programs? And what makes the most sense for you as a company, given perhaps existing relationships and other situations where, you know, you could take a real advantage of tapping into the Lockton Global Partnership. So it's just, I find it a very different approach than what I've seen in publicly traded companies. I would say another distinction is our partnership with Salesforce. We are partnering with one of the most prestigious software development companies in the world. And we are taking full advantage of the things that they're doing for their entire client base that we are able to tap into, whereas our competitors have a more grow their own type of a strategy, thinking that, you know, benefits are complicated and so only people that know benefits can design technology to manage them. And that's just not been the experience that we've had with Salesforce. And I think that that partnership is going to translate into such meaningful advantages for our clients because they're going to be able to take advantage of the evolution of technology and incorporating that into the ways in which they're managing their benefits so much faster as well.
And just to be clear, because I think most people think of Salesforce and they think of CRMs, you know, like sales, like a sales tool, Salesforce. And what you're talking about is we're actually using it to aggregate all the in-country data and then create reports back to the actual client. So this is a client-facing tool, not an internal sales tool. And
that's exactly right.
Ours is called Navigator.
That's exactly right.
And is the one, and everything that you were talking about getting your arms around all the data and having a partner help you understand the policies, the design, the financials, the utilization, all that goes into the system you're talking
about. Yeah. And that inventory tool is not unique to Lockton. Other companies have their own as well. I think the difference is that the underlying platform is Salesforce, and it's actually their financial services platform, not their CRM at all. It just affords us the ability to do a lot with the data that we do collect. And, you know, with everything that's happening with artificial intelligence and what we're seeing that Salesforce is incorporating into that operating platform, it's just going to take us to the next level in a very short period of time. It's a very exciting moment to be working with them and in this field. And because of the partnership, you know, they're building stuff that is kind of specific to what we're asking for. So that's another differentiator that I've just noticed in the short time that I've been here. And frankly, and we hear this all the time, right? I don't think this is a global benefits space. This is the Lockton culture. The people that are here at Lockton, they're here for a reason and they're good people. They want to do their best for their clients, and we will always make the right decisions based on our client needs. And that's something that, again, publicly traded companies might not always be able to say.
Well, we appreciate the addition of your skill sets and energy and talent to the team. It is very needed. It is very timely. And I really appreciate you coming on and spending your time here today to educate our audience. So, Shannon, thank you very much.
No, thank you. Thank you again for the opportunity.
Hey, folks, one last thing before you go. If you enjoyed the episode, make sure to hit subscribe so you can stay up to date with future guests. That's it. Thanks for coming. Go make the most of your business and the people in it.